This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me
Colin Dyer.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Colin, you were talking about the showgrounds and the sorts of events that you were catering for there. And I think there's a lot to hear about the sort of personalities that you met on the way as well. But would you like to tell us a bit more about the...
Yes, of course, Stuart. And of course, operating events was the highlight of being part of the showgrounds, or Arena Manawatu, as later it became when we rebranded it. So during that period of the early 90s was when we really did develop a name for ourselves in Palmerston North and at the Palmerston North Showgrounds for attracting lots of international and national events. And in fact, in 1993, the New Zealand Conference Association determined from statistics that Palmerston North was the fourth busiest sporting and tournament centre in New Zealand. And there's no question that the Palmerston North Showgrounds was by far the most foremost initiator of that. And indeed, during the most of the 90s, television time focused on Palmerston North. More than 90% of Palmerston North's exposure came through events at the Palmerston North Showgrounds. The sort of events that we tried to specialise in, notwithstanding that the community sport and recreation, of course, remained the solid base and in most years accounted for 50 to 60% of the total use of all the venues. The variety of other events, such as International League Rugby, we had the Rugby Sevens, we even had a, we never had an All Black Test, but we did have New Zealand playing Canada in games like that, New Zealand Murrays. We had the All Whites play there three times internationally. We had a very prominent international personality cricket match on the Oval, which was a little bit short on boundaries, but the people loved all the sixes.
You're half smiling there. There's some stories around that event, I take it.
Well, I think the biggest story perhaps that sort of got a lot of focus at the time, but in 1993, I believe it was, we had a famous rugby league test between Australia and New Zealand, where they, as a promotional play to the crowd prior to the game, and we had 20,000 people in, the biggest crowd that I can recall around the Oval in terms of seated capacity, they kicked, I think it was 15 free promotional footballs out into the crowd prior to the game. But unfortunately, in an administrative sense, they made a big mistake because they then played the test match with only three balls. And so inevitably, someone decided one of those balls should be kept by them when it went over the sideline. And so with 48 seconds to play right at the end of the game, the referee had to stop the match because they couldn't find a football. So that was a terrible, unfortunate situation, which was none of our making, but really New Zealand Rugby League were to blame.
So the game finished early.
Well, no, unfortunately the referee should have simply wrapped the game up, I would have thought, with 48 seconds to go. Australia was leading something like 20-8 at the time. It was a very cold, wintry, snowy sort of night, and so people were frozen stiff. But no, he decided he had to play the last few seconds. So they eventually, the officials, found another football, went to the change rooms, pumped it up, and after a delay of about 10 minutes, enormous delay, and the people were becoming naturally very restless, the game finally concluded. But that was very unfortunate and did give us a bad reputation at the time, because the crowd was quite close to the sidelines to get that many people in. In fact, the rugby league had oversold the ground, but that's a slightly different story. Yes, a special council meeting was called. I was called to account because Palmerston North had suffered some bad reputation over this. But in the end, of course, it was New Zealand Rugby League that accepted the responsibility for not having enough footballs to play the game with.
Yeah, they were the ones who were supposed to bring the balls.
Absolutely. Yeah. But of course, the media, you know, got into to us somewhat, and even 3 or 4 days later, we still had a TV crew arrive wanting to film the ground where all this had happened, and making the most of, you know, what was not a particularly pleasant affair. So I can understand how people that are in the spotlight certainly get pinned down on occasion.
So that was a bit of a bad look for Palmerston North, but generally you say all these sporting events coming to Palmerston North, what was the national image of Palmerston North with it?
Very much a central point, easy geography, very central to get to, good accommodation facilities, and particularly for sporting tournaments. We had the biggest Australasia badminton tournament each year of schools, and we frequently had things like the National League basketball finals each year, which were very prominent and televised at that time. Several times we had the National Netball finals, regional in New Zealand. We had volleyball tournaments and test matches. Indoor hockey was a major event, and they also had test matches and national tournaments. Across a whole range of sports, skating was another one that we had prominent national events.
Is that roller skating?
Yeah, and inline roller skating, artistic and speed and inline. Also things like national bowls tournaments we had a lot of. Table tennis was another prominent sport, where we had international veterans table tennis tournament, as well as national table tennis tournaments. We had the national touch tournament several times. We had the national marching tournament. We had the national pipe bands contest. We even had gridiron being played on a regional basis, American football. So yeah, we were always innovators, setting up new sports, and over that time we developed a lot of regular programs, and so it's fair to say that we had something around 40 different sporting and recreation codes being played there regularly. So that's a lot of different sporting codes. And later, when I was involved in the as being president of the Entertainment Venues Association, and also at much the same time, the late 90s, a executive council member of the Venue Management Association based in Australia, Asia Pacific, I was able to visit lots of venues throughout Asia and Australasia, and I do not know and have not come across any other facility in the whole southern hemisphere which provides so many different recreation forms. Not sure what year, but we twice had the All Black Trials because prior to picking teams for overseas tours, it was traditional at that time that they would often have either a North-South game or an All Black Trial. And I recall on this particular occasion, I think the All Blacks were due to go to Europe. We had the All Black Trials, and the particular selector and coach at the time was one Gris Wiley, of considerable renown in New Zealand. He was assisted by Earl Curtin. The selectors arrived. This is Griz Wiley, Earl Curtin, and another fellow called Lane Penn, who was very much the sort of junior of the trio. We had an exciting All Black trial. I think there were two different games. At the end of the games, the coach, Griz Wiley, assisted by the other two selectors, was to pick the All Black team to go to Europe, and that was then to be announced to the media, who were waiting to announce the All Black team. Earl Curtin, when he arrived, seemed very keen and quite focused mainly on me protecting a particular bottle of wine that he'd brought with him, and would I make sure that it was chilled to appropriate temperature and ready for the after-match celebrations, which of course are always part of these events. In any event, the games concluded. I'd cleared my office ready for the media to interview Griz Wiley to announce the team. Television was standing by, radio and a few others. But when the time came, no one could find Earl Curtin. So Griz is getting pretty grisly at this stage, because although we used the PA to try and find him, we didn't have a lot of success. Lane Penn was running around everywhere looking for him as well. We eventually found Earl Curtin, who was a very sociable man. In fact, he had a reputation always as a selector of standing behind the goalpost during a game, and a lot of rugby followers would know that. Anyway, we did find Earl and his bottle of wine, and finally the team could be selected and announced. But just before that, I suggested to Griz Wiley that I could help him, and I produced a list of prospective members of the team just as a bit of a, I guess, a joke to try and make him a little bit more sociable. As it happened, I was only one player out, but he didn't think it was very funny when I suggested my list to him. So, yes, my association with him was interesting as well. One of the other little highlights or anecdotes that particularly sticks in my mind and is probably still talked about around the city was the time we had Tina Turner come to our stadium, probably one of the greatest international entertainer stars that we ever had, and we were very pleased and fortunate to have her. We deranged to have two concerts over two consecutive nights here in Palmerston North, because these sort of events attracted people from throughout the North Island who found it reasonably easy to get to Palmerston North. It was a good central point, and with our Manawatu Sports Stadium, it was an ideal venue. The capacity of the sports stadium was generally considered to be tops 5,000 people, depending on the seating configuration, and often for concerts there was quite a lot of unseated attendance as well. On this particular occasion, I'd made a special provision with the fire service and the city council to have additional staff on hand at all the doors and fire safety wardens and so on additionally. So we had 6,000 people in, which to my knowledge was the most that the stadium had ever had. So 6,000 people all enjoying Tina Turner in full swing and all the popular songs. About two-thirds of the way through the concert, suddenly I found the police, who'd taken control out of my hands, were clearing the stadium because they'd received a bomb threat. Now, previously on the night, prior to our concert in Wellington, there'd been a bomb threat and the same thing had happened. So I guess there was always the possibility that some hoax was going to happen again. So you can imagine Tina Turner was very displeased with this, having to clear the whole stadium midway through the concert. I was certainly very upset that as manager of the stadium and in control, the police had completely overridden my authority and without consultation, and really quite irresponsibly in my view.
Well, would you have reacted to the bomb threat in the same way?
Well, I had certainly had bomb threats before. They weren't particularly new to me, and generally, I would carry a more thorough search procedure before I would have evacuated the stadium in this manner.
So what would the nature of a threat be if you had several of these?
Formerly, when I was managing the Plaza and PDC, this was not unusual. So I had certainly dealt with bomb threats before, and of course they're generally hoaxes. But of course you can never be really certain. But I mean, there are search provisions and other things that you can undertake. So in this case, yes, the police did not follow the correct procedure at all, and that was very unfortunate that we had this situation occur.
Okay, so these happen quite often. It's probably a disgruntled customer or someone with a grievance.
No, just someone wanting to just be an arc. Yeah, just someone.
And it's just a phone call or a written message?
Yes, it was a phone call out of a phone box.
Phone call. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, it was clearly similar as to what had happened in Wellington the previous night or the night before the previous night.
The normal idea then would be you have just a quick...
Well, we would do a thorough search of the building, and we were prepared to do that. And indeed, once the building was evacuated, that's exactly what we did do. And we had to then reassemble 6,000 people back inside again, which of course they weren't very happy, naturally, nor was Tina Turner. So, yes, it was just unfortunate that the police did not follow the normal procedures of stadium management with proper communication and usual responsibilities. But however, talking about that sort of thing, yes, twice I can think of the grandstand having to be evacuated because some fool had pressed the fire alarm button in the change room.
Yeah.
So those sorts of things are part of risk management in terms of major events. And, you know, I see on the current Royal Tour that the same thing happened last night at Government House with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. So any major event, you're always considering all the things that can go wrong and having to try and have some event plan which deals with all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why some of the, I think, what was it, Hillsborough, the problem there, how come that...
Yeah, Hillsborough...
Obviously, that was a system failure there.
No, Hillsborough was a particularly unfortunate and very disastrous situation, but that particular videotape was very much part of standard management, venue management training as to how you should deal with a grandstand fire, and was frequently shown at seminars and by the fire service and others. So I guess from that tragedy, there was a lot of learning to be done. Yeah, that brings me to another point as well, that during the time I was manager of the Palmerston North Showgrounds, Arena Manawatu, and my association with the Australasian Asia Pacific Venue Management Association, I was one of the initiators of setting up in Queensland a venue management school whereby young people, because this was a sort of new developing career, event management and sports management. So not only did I do some guest lecturing at Massey University in terms of sports and recreation management, but I had a hand in setting up this venue management school in Australia, which is still going now 25 years later, and is very much key to developing skills and management of venues throughout Australasia.
Okay, now that's interesting. You had a broad range of experience, and you were lecturing in this sort of thing, you know, guest lectures and so on. Did you have training leading up to this sort of career development, or...
No, that's a good question, Stuart. And I think, you know, when I look back, I was fortunate to be at a time when venue management was just in its very early stages of development and in its infancy. And when I look at the development of sport management and all sorts of different associations and groups which didn't exist in 1987, and I see how many young people now do these degrees and want to get into sports and venue management or events management, it just didn't exist in my day. And so the whole development of it as a skill, you know, was just something that I guess I was part of, and belonging to these different associations and taking leading roles in them It was about, in my own case, arriving at a job, a vocation, which we didn't have very much infrastructure at all, and where I had to develop things like measuring hours of use and bookings and returns per square meter and all sorts of performance measures that didn't exist before that. But with retail management training, some of those things were was sort of what I was used to performing too. And of course, events management is a very exciting field, and as I say, is now a very popular choice of young students with huge amount of increased opportunities. I think I've mentioned to you before that when I first dealt with Netball New Zealand, there was a CEO who had two staff, and when I used to do bookings for international or national events with Netball, I basically dealt with one of the players who had a part-time role organising dates and venues for next year's events. So it was very much a less developed sort of infrastructure than it is today, when so many of these sporting organisations now have huge staff and big roles.
You think that they're more efficiently done these days, or is it just more complex to...
Oh, I'm sure it is more efficient, but I sometimes do wonder whether the productivity is as high as it used to be, because you know what we used to achieve at the Palmerston North Showgrounds with a team of about eight people running all these major events, and just bringing in extra volunteers when I needed them for, you know, gatekeeping or security or whatever, compared to venues these days that require, you know, a team of 25 to do the same thing, and with much less activity.
Yeah. Bigger overheads coming.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Yes, and if one looks at the Palmerston North Showgrounds annual accounts today, they do not seem as proportionate in terms of costs and income as we achieved in the 1990s.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you met quite a few interesting personalities in your...
Yes, I think some of the ones that... I'll just find those notes here.
I seem to recall that on another occasion you mentioned Rob Muldoon.
Yes, I did too, that's right. Yes, some of the really particularly interesting people I feel that did make an impression on me was, Rob Muldoon, who was not actually Prime Minister at the time. He had been previously. At this stage, he'd been... he'd been backbenched, but a most prominent New Zealander, rather grumpy person on the day that I got to host him, which was meeting him off the plane and looking after him for a whole day during the National Beef Bull Sale Week, when we'd arranged to have a debate with Roger Douglas, Rob Muldoon and several other prominent politicians here in our grandstand lounge, and that proved to be very popular.
Yeah, this would have been what, about 1987, or one of your early days in the...
Yes, I think about 1990 thereabouts.
Oh,
roughly.
Okay.
Yes,
that would have been a lively debate.
It was, and we used to bring some pretty prominent New Zealand people to that event each year. One of the sports people who really did make a great impression on me was Mel Meninga. Mel Meninga was at that time one of the great Australian rugby league players, the Kangaroos. An incredibly well-built fellow with enormous strength and agility and speed, and I would certainly not have wanted to tackle him. But very much a gentleman, very quiet, unassuming fellow, and such an amazing player. It's fair to say in those days I did sort of feel that the All Black players or the rugby players tended to be a little bit more full of themselves than the rugby league players did, who were often playing second fiddle. This was before professional rugby, and of course a lot has changed now, and I think, you know, the prominent rugby players certainly are much more groomed and developed in terms of those skills than they were then. I met Jonah Lomu in his very early days as a star at the National Rugby Sevens.
Just so you said something interesting. I know there's in New Zealand there's like the tall poppy thing, but at the same time the All Blacks are on a pedestal. But you say now it's in the professional era, they get media training as to how to present in the right way?
Yes, I think they see it as much more of a professional career than some of the players that I met initially, who, we're often, just a little bit more full of their own importance, I felt.
Okay.
There were some very good ones there too, but some were clearly almost to the point of being arrogant, I would have said, compared to the lesser stars such as the Silver Ferns, who were always so pleasant and delightful to deal with and were always so grateful for everything you did. Rugby players weren't necessarily in that same niche.
Okay, yep.
Rugby league players, because they were striving to get to these sort of venues, did appreciate the opportunity to play at a venue such as ours when they were very much previously restricted to Carlaw Park and Addington Showgrounds. And they did appreciate and show their appreciation.
So what do you think then about the media treatment of the top All Blacks in the amateur era compared to now? Are they judged a bit more harshly now they're professional, do you think?
I'm not sure that there's a great deal of difference, because they were always extremely prominent in the media prior to that. I mean, the Colin Meads and the Brian Lahores and the Cal Tremaines, I mean, they were very much household names and some brilliant players, absolutely, and some real gentlemen amongst them, like the Michael Jones who I met. Sometimes they would not have had near the same sort of training, coaching and development that they have today terms of how they present and brand rugby in the way that they now do. I recall an afternoon kicking balls back to Christian Cullen when he was practising his goal kicking, and of course he was a fantastic rugby player, a very unassuming guy, and someone who I did very much admire. One of the best coaches I ever came across was a lady called Lois Muir, who coached the netball Silver Ferns for many years, and I would still think would be probably the best coach New Zealand's ever had in terms of netball. An amazing lady with incredible personality and skill, and yet firmness of character and ability that was to be admired. Of the very, very many conferences and international conferences in some cases, gave me an opportunity to meet lots of prominent people. But one of those that made a very good impression on me was Tipene O'Regan, who at that time was the kaimanawa of the Ngāi Tahu. He was very prominent in developing the Ngāi Tahu funds from the treaty settlements into something of meaningful value for Ngāi Tahu. And we had the National Fishermen's Conference, which he was particularly prominent at, and I had the opportunity during a morning tea to spend some time with him and to talk to him at some length about where he saw the vision of his people. Frank Endicott, one of the great coaches of the rugby league Kiwis, particularly easy to get on with fellow, who very much was a great personality amongst his players. Kieran Smith, who currently continues to be New Zealand's president of the IOAC, the International Olympic and Commonwealth Games Organising Committee. She was the first CEO of Sport Manawatū, and her and I set up Sports House, which was only the second one, I think, in New Zealand at the time. The whole concept of having a building, an office where all sorts of sporting organisations at nil or very low cost rental could all accommodate together and use some of the administrative skills in a communal way. So Kieran Smith was an outstanding person and continues to be. Royalty, I had the opportunity to meet Prince Andrew during the presentation of the colours to the New Zealand Engineer Regiment based at Linton, Logistics Regiment actually, and that was a big occasion as well.
Yeah. When was that?
I can't remember exactly the date, but during the 1990s. So yeah, just a few of the wonderful personalities that that impressed me in my time.
Thank you for listening to Manawatū Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatū People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatū Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this programme and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.